This episode is brought to you by the American Homebrewers Association, a network of more than 40,000 people dedicated to the appreciation of beer, cider, and mead. Join the AHA for just $3.99 a month at homebrewersassociation.org. That's homebrewersassociation.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 10th, 2020. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Colby, author of the new book, How to Make Hard Seltzer, talks about how to make hard seltzer. The process sounds deceptively easy, but I can tell you from personal experience that it's trickier than you think. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. I posted a bonus video for financial subscribers on Monday, and I hope that everybody had a great Labor Day weekend, by the way. Due to technical problems, scheduling issues, and other excuses, we were only able to get one video episode out last month, so I wanted to make sure financial subscribers are getting value for their contributions. So I put together a quick video showing my process of fermenting peppers and making hot sauce. Following Sandor Katz's advice, it's really simple. I'm on my third batch of hot sauce now using some habanero and aji dulce peppers that a friend brought over from his garden. And I think it's going to be the hottest batch yet. And I'm really looking forward to tasting how the fermentation process affects the flavor. He brought me lots of habaneros, so I went ahead and made a cooked batch of my hot sauce, my traditional recipe that I got from my friend Ed, who also brought the peppers. And so, again, it'd be fun to compare the cooked version against the fermented version. Steve and I did get together yesterday to shoot two video episodes, so fingers crossed everything worked technically there. One of the episodes was about an experiment that Steve did in using conditioning yeast when bottling a beer that had been lagering for a few months. You know, when you have a beer lagering for a few months, you think, well, you know, the yeast is all settled out and, you know, you want to add some yeast in the bottling process to kind of as an insurance policy. So that was a fun experiment. And the other one was about my attempt to make a chaos sizer clone with bread yeast. In the first attempt a few weeks ago, first attempt at shooting this show, Steve wasn't thrilled with the yeast character that the bread yeast brought. So will aging the sizer a couple more weeks improve this? Well, you'll just have to watch and see. I got the recipe for that sizer from the website of our friends and sponsors at Groenfell Meadery. At groenfell.com, that's groenfell.com, you can find that recipe along with others. And you can also order their meads online to ship to you. Ricky the mead maker is excited about Wild Hunt, a limited fall seasonal mead that's available for pre-sale right now. Wild Hunt is a balanced blend of honey, cranberry, blood orange, and spice, brewed in honor of ceremonial meads of 18th century Northern Europe. Sounds delicious. I was able to get my hands on a selection of Groenfell and Chaos Meads. Chaos Meads are made up there at that same meadery. And Susan and I have been really enjoying them, like Valkyrie's Choice, which is a nice, simple, basic mead, Havoc's Hop Swarm, which is a dry-hopped mead, Old Wayfarer, an oaked amber mead, and Havoc's Psychopomp, which is a cherry sour mead, a sour cherry mead. They're all moderate gravity and carbonated, so they're deliciously drinkable, and the pint cans make them great for chilling by the lake. We love Ricky and Kelly and everybody at Groenfell. Check them out at groenfell.com. Let's take a look into the mailbag. A few episodes ago, Aaron wrote in from New Zealand looking for Nuruk to make makgeolli, the Korean rice wine. He was looking for alternatives for Nuruk, which is the stuff that has the enzymes and the yeast to convert and ferment the rice. Well, listener Will wrote in with some good information. Will says, if I can help the other listener shorten the long search it took for me, Nuruk for making makgeolli is available at H Mart and in and around Auckland. It's not labeled as Nuruk. It's usually either enzyme or malt powder, but nothing works as well as a picture. So here's a picture of the bag I got at H Mart. So he sent a picture. They also sell glutinous rice. I used jasmati the first time and glutinous the second. I was surprised at how much difference there was between the two. Glutinous was easier to work with, broke down better, and tasted better. Well, there you go. Thanks, Will. I appreciate that. And I'm sure Aaron will, too. I sent an email along with the photos to Aaron. I also got a question on our YouTube video on makgeolli asking how long it would keep. I recently found a PET bottle of makgeolli that I made about 2 years ago in the back of the fridge. I shook it up and I tasted it, and it was still very nice. So maybe with the high alcohol and the refrigeration, you know, makgeolli might keep for a long time. Of course, your mileage may vary. Let's talk about our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. You'll hear me talk to Chris Colby about struggling with my fermentation of hard seltzer. And I didn't use Imperial for that. Maybe I should have. I've never had anything but success in using Imperial Organic Yeast. You know, previously, I always made starters with liquid yeast. That was just a given. Otherwise, I'd pitch and hope the airlock would be bubbling, 24 hours later. But not with Imperial. With the highest pitch rate of any liquid yeast producer, 200 billion cells, my stir plate is dusty. When I pitch Imperial in the afternoon, there's usually airlock activity by bedtime. I can sleep well knowing there's delicious beer in the works. And the recommended shelf life for Imperial pouches is 4 months. Pair the excellent product with top-notch technical support and customer service, and you've got a winner there. Ask your homebrew shop owner about Imperial Organic Yeast and check out their collection of strains at imperialyeast.com. Okay, hard seltzers are popular nowadays. Some hardcore craft beer lovers may turn their noses up at them, but people like them. And it turns out they may be a fun challenge for homebrewers to tackle. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me on the show.
You wrote a new book, and I'm surprised that you didn't dedicate it to the late, great Chuckles the Clown, who famously said, "A little song, a little dance, a little seltzer down your pants." I think that would have been more appropriate.
Yeah, what did I dedicate it to? Oh, scientists.
Yeah. Oh, there you
scientists
go.
Scientists deserve it.
Well, right behind Chuckles the Clown.
Yeah. Well, my next book is actually on science and brewing, so maybe I'll dedicate that to clowns. Balance things out.
So the book is called How to Make Hard Seltzer, Refreshing Recipes for Sparkling Libations. There's always got to be a colon with more stuff after the title.
Yeah, publishers love that stuff.
And I thought, now this is going to be an easy thing to do, and we can get into it later, but I'm in the middle of attempting a hard cider or hard seltzer, and I'm going to say hard cider. Please correct me every time I say hard cider, because I've been saying that a lot. So I tried a hard seltzer myself, and I had some problems, so we can get into that later. So what are we talking about here? What is the definition of hard seltzer?
Yeah, hard seltzer, or I'm going to probably call them fizzy belch water a lot. Hard seltzers are a brewed alcoholic beverage, and there's a lot of them now, and there's the boundaries are pushing outward. But a sort of a classic hard seltzer is a clear alcoholic beverage, usually 4 to 5% alcohol by volume. All the the first wave of them, White Claw, Bon and Viv, Truly, the classic, quote unquote, are 4 to 5% alcohol by volume, and now there's higher alcohol ones. The classic ones were and are 90 to 100 calories per 12 ounce serving. So this is less than normal beer, slightly less, although pretty much in the ballpark of like light beer. And, you know, it is a little more than there are the super light beers like Michelob Ultra or whatever, but, you know, fairly low calorie. They're low in carbohydrates. There's generally, it's generally below 5 grams of carbohydrates. A lot of times it's even under 2. So, the calories in these 90 to 100, that's almost entirely from alcohol. Hmm. There's no, these aren't very sweet. If a hard seltzer has 2 grams of carbohydrates per 12 ounce serving, that's like 1/20th of a typical soda, you know, which are around 39 or 40 yeah. grams per, or sometimes higher even. Now, they're also, a lot of them are advertised as being gluten-free because they're drank by a lot of people who perceive them as healthy somehow. And so the producers of it try to do as much as they can without, you know, saying that. And so some of them are advertised as gluten-free. And then they're highly carbonated. They're like 2.8 volumes of CO2 is sort of the industry standard. And that's above, you know, like a typical American Pilsner or a craft beer, American craft ale, are usually about 2.5 volumes of CO2. German Hefeweizen's 4 to 5 volumes of CO2 is you know, what those are. And champagne can be up to 6. So 2.8 is, you know, fizzy but not super carbonated. And then finally the pH of them is relatively low. They aren't sour, but the pH is usually down to about 3.1, which is like a little lower than white wines, and, you know, definitely lower than beer, which is, you know, lager beers usually has a pH around 4, and an ale, a non-sour ale might be a little bit below that, down to 3.8 maybe, you know. So that's what a hard seltzer is.
Now, last year, I went to a brewery. And I'm not going to say where, but there was this big, you know, those big plastic cubes, giant plastic cubes, that are meant to hold liquid. And they got the little metal cage around them and they sit on a pallet, those giant containers. And I was like, what's that? And he said, oh, that's ethanol because we're going to make hard seltzers. So that's not what we're talking about, right? We're not just like diluting pre-existing alcohol into and carbonating it, right?
No, that's you can do it that way. I wonder if the TTB showed up at the guy's brewery later to tell him, you know, because that's generally not how brewers do it, because they'll get taxed at a higher rate and then lots of things, but who cares? Yeah, this is the book I wrote is on how to brew them, you know, like the producers of hard seltzers do. So starting with the sugar wash that you ferment, and then you add your flavors, and then you carbonate it.
But there are two different kinds. There's a malt beverage, and there's a beer. And they're not necessarily the ones that you would think.
Yeah, in the U.S., the TTB has some crazy convoluted, you know, definitions, and then, you know, the IRS is also involved, so everything gets more needlessly complex. But you can, there was a TTB ruling back in the day, fairly recently, that changed the definition of beer from, you know, a beverage brewed with malt to a beverage brewed with malt or malt substitutes, and it listed sugar as a malt substitute. So you can ferment sugar and water and sell it as a beer under TTB regulations. But there were previous regulations that applied to like Zima and Mike's Hard Lemonade and all those that you could sell something labeled a malt beverage that used up to 75% sugar, but it had to have 25% malt and 7.1, if I remember right, 7.1 pounds of hops per barrel. Okay, which is tiny.
Is it per barrel or per 100 barrels?
Oh, per 100 barrels, you're right. That's a tiny amount. And so, and that's a malt beverage. So under the TTB code, just sugar and water, no hops at all. That's a beer, or people in the industry are calling that an IRC beer, for Internal Revenue Code beer. And, but, you know, a little bit of malt and a little bit of hops changes that from a beer into a malt beverage, which is basically 100% backwards about how, you know, most brewers would think about it.
Why would you want to brew one over the other?
Cost, complications, also some state regulations might force you to do the malt beverage rather than the beer for tax purposes. There's a lot of ins and outs of getting distribution, but most of the hard seltzers produced these days are of the IRC beer type, just sugar water. And then, if they need to break into a market that requires them to add malt and hops, then they'll do that.
Yeah, it seems to be, I mean, if you're making a malt beverage with a portion of it being barley or malt, and if you're forced to use hops in a beverage that's basically supposed to be flavorless before you add flavorless and colorless before you add the flavorings,
right.
You've got to go through extra steps to strip it down to, you know, the base solution before you get finished with it.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and we'll get into that later, but they also start by making the colors and flavors as little as possible. Like obviously you'd want to use the lightest colored malt possible. And one thing you could do is use chit malt. If you if you recall, chit malt is like barely malted barley. You know, it's so very low in color, and you'd then probably have to add exogenous enzymes even to help your mash along. But in the terms of hops, this is a funny thing. There's no requirement that you add hop cones. It's just hops. You can, and people do, add hop leaves, the part of the hop plant that you don't use for brewing, simply to fulfill the government requirement. They also use, and this is true, spent hops. They'll take hops from a beer boil, rinse them with water so there's no, you know, wort associated with them left, and then use these hops that don't have, you know, or have a very depleted amount of alpha acids in them for the boil of the hard seltzer. And you know, additionally, there's no specification in the government regulations about if weight means dry weight or wet weight. So if you're using spent hops that you've rinsed with water, you know, they're soaking wet, so the amount of actual hop material is low compared to if you're using, you know, pellet hops or you know, cone hops. So it's weird. And one of the things I talk about in the history section of the book, which is sort of at least for me, a minor thing, is just how, you know, weird government regulations end up with countries producing products that like nobody would have ever asked for, you know. And hard seltzer is one, because nobody, like, prior to hard seltzers coming out, nobody said, I would really like, you know, a clear beverage that tastes like TV static. You know, nobody would say that. And the phrase TV static has to be credited to Ashton Lewis, because he's the one who told me that. the TTB regulation got changed. Somebody said, hey, let's try this, market it, and it caught on. Crazy.
Because people like them.
Yeah. Oh, people really like them. I mean, when they were introduced, a lot of people, who operate under the assumption that beverages should taste good, said, you know, that this will never fly. This will be like something that young women millennials will drink in the summer, and that's it. But since then, they've shown that they're selling with males and females roughly equally. The first few years, you know, they really started picking up in 2016. And the first few years, they did show a strong seasonality, but now they sell year-round. And the amount of older people who are drinking them keeps ratcheting up. So they've totally blown apart all the predictions about them. And breweries right now are a lot of them are trying to get, most of them, I'd say, are trying to get on that, you know, bandwagon, because you're just, if you're not brewing one, you're just leaving money on the table.
Yeah, and speaking of money, during these hard times for breweries, this is a, you know, to brew a fairly profitable, popular item could be saving the businesses of some of these breweries.
Yeah, it very definitely. Right now, with so many breweries on the edge, every little bit counts. And, you know, I know a lot of brewers, and, you know, probably literally most brewers aren't excited about the product itself, but are, you know, wanting to brew something that is going to bring in customers and that they're, you know, people are going to enjoy.
Well, I'm excited about it because I always like to brew something new, even if it's not generally down my line of tastes. But, you know, sometimes I surprise myself. So let's talk about the ingredients. First of all, water. I mean, you would think that water is pretty important because it is the main ingredient of the beer.
Yep. And if you're a home brewer, the good news is you pretty much already know how to treat your water. You're going to know you're either filtering it through carbon to get rid of the chloramines, or you're, you know, adding a Camden tablet. Beyond that, you don't really need to match the concentration of minerals in your water to the mash type, because there is no mash. You know, about the only thing is if you had incredibly soft water, you know, if there's just nothing, no dissolved minerals, you might want to add some calcium chloride and some calcium or some calcium sulfate, you know, gypsum, to your water just a little bit. You know, bump it up to 50 or 100 parts per million of calcium, and just that might make your water taste a little better. And you can totally test that, because water is like there's no strong flavors in a hard seltzer, so the flavor of your water is definitely going to influence the beverage.
And you said in the book, unlike in beer, where there's some buffering characteristics of the ingredients, where the ingredients in a hard seltzer, pretty much what you put in is what you get?
Yeah, in terms of pH, because sugar, it's not an acid, it's not a base, and it's not a buffer. You know, when you add sugar to water, it doesn't dissociate into a positive and negative ions. It's all covalently bonded. So there's no, you know, it doesn't change the pH one way or the other. And it's not a buffer. You know, it doesn't have it requires the molecules to dissociate for buffering to occur. So whatever the pH of your water is, add sugar to it, and that's the pH of your sugar water. Hmm. So one thing, when you mix up your initial mixture of either glucose and sucrose and water, is as an option, it's not actually critical, but you might want to add acid to knock the pH down to the level of wort. You know, when you, at the end of a brewery boil, the pH has dropped from, you know, 5.2 to 5.6 from, you know, the sweet wort from the mash down to about 5.0 generally post-boil. And so dropping your sugar wash down to about 5.0, you know, just and you can ballpark that. That doesn't need to be exactly. Is going to help the yeast just get off to more of a running start.
Let's talk about sugar. What kind of sugar can we use?
The most popular kinds are just either sucrose or glucose. Sucrose is usually sold as an anhydrous crystal. It's just anhydrous means not with water. And, you know, that's just plain table sugar. Glucose, usually sold as glucose monohydrate. Like if you go to the store or a homebrew store and buy corn sugar, That's glucose monohydrate, and that's glucose, and every molecule of glucose is ionically bonded to a water molecule. So it's a dry powder, but there's still water weight to it. So those two are the most commonly used sugars. I mean, you can use any kind of sugar. You know, you could use, you know, honey, as some are all the sugars. Honey's mostly fructose, or at least it's a large amount of fructose in it. And, you know, you can use whatever, but given that you want to end up with a colorless, flavorless beverage, sucrose and glucose are the way most commercial brewers go.
And if you use honey, you're making something else. I think it's called mead. You're making mead.
Mead.
which is delicious, but another show. I used dextrose in mine, but you're calling it glucose.
Dextrose and glucose are two names for the same thing. I think dextrose refers specifically to glucose from corn.
But don't get confused if you go to your homebrew shop and they just have corn sugar or dextrose. That's what we're going to refer to probably as glucose.
As glucose, because that's what it is, and then it has other names for various historical reasons.
Are there different gravities? You say that glucose or dextrose has some water in it. Do you get a less gravity per pound of that sugar than sucrose?
You need to add a little bit more by weight glucose than the sucrose. For a 5-gallon batch, you need it's something like 3 1/3 to 4 1/3 pounds of sucrose per 5 gallons, and it's I think 4.2 to 5.2 pounds of glucose per 5 gallons if you're making a beverage in the 4 to 5% ABV range.
And then, since we just got sugar and water, what kind of yeast should we choose?
Okay, yeah. One other thing you should put in the boil, though, is some yeast nutrients. I mean, that's critical, because a mixture of sugar and water has a carbon source for the yeast. The sugar has carbon in it, but there's no nitrogen in it. It's, you know, glucose is C6H12O6. There's no N in there, and sucrose is basically twice that, minus an H2O. So it needs nitrogen. And so one source of nitrogen is DAP, diammonium phosphate. That's a nutrient that people use for in winemaking a lot. It's also, farmers spread it on their field. Anyway, yeah, you need some yeast nutrients, but even just DAP isn't going to do it. That's going to add, you know, ammonia, which has nitrogen in it, to your mix. But it's going to, you're going to also need zinc, you know, calcium, magnesium, other trace nutrients, would help to have some amino acids and stuff. And so most of the big yeast producing companies sell something they label as a complete yeast nutrient. And these are generally a blend of DAP and yeast hulls, which is just dead yeast. So it contains all the things that yeast need. And, you know, there's generally some zinc added as well. And it may be also supplemented with amino acids, which are another bioavailable source of nitrogen. And anyway, so you need all three of those things. You need carbon, nitrogen, and, you know, the sort of complete spectrum of things you get from a complete yeast nutrient.
So the approach to brewing a hard seltzer is sort of like brewing a mead. You got to, since the honey is simple sugar, you've got to feed and take care of your yeast to make it work.
There's a lot of similarities, because, you know, one of the problems with at least some meads is some honeys are fairly acidic, so you need to adjust the pH. In case of meads, you need to adjust it upwards. In the case of hard seltzers, it at least helps to adjust it downwards. It's not critical, because, as I said, they're not buffered. So once the yeast start working, they're going to drop the pH pretty quickly. But adjusting it early makes a hospitable, environment for them. And then the yeast nutrient situation is very similar. You know, there is some free amino nitrogen in mead musts, but it's not low, and you need to add you know, some yeast nutrients. One interesting thing about the sugar wash for a hard seltzer is that you can calculate or you can hit your target of free amino nitrogen you want exactly because your initial amount is zero. Hmm. So then if you can just add whatever you add, that's your level of free amino nitrogen. In a mead, there's a little bit of a guessing game because there is some free, it's not enough to you know, push the yeast for a full ordered fermentation, but there's some. And so you either have to guess, you know, and add a part, an amount you think is reasonable and has worked in the past, or you have to send, you know, the honey off for, you know, analysis. So one weird nice thing about hard seltzers is that if you're trying to hit your, you know, hit your numbers for free amino nitrogen in the sugar wash, all you have to do is count up how much you add.
Huh. Now, can we talk about yeast? What kind and how much?
What kind is a good question. They're made commercially from a wide variety of yeast. It's not like there's one strain out there that everyone's using. A lot of breweries just use their house strain because, you know, for obvious reasons, that's what they have a lot on hand. And any brewery strain that, you know, is at least fairly neutral and is at least, you know, fairly attenuative, is probably going to work if you can take care of the yeast nutrition. You know, so something like any of the quote unquote Chico strains out there, you know, Y Yeast 1056, Fermentis US05, White Labs WP001, and you know, a score of others that are basically the Sierra Nevada strain. Those all work. Any other one will work. Wine yeast strains, something like EC 1118 will work. D47 will work. And pretty much any white wine strain, unless it's meant to produce a sweet wine, you know, or sweet wine by leaving unfermented sugars. You know, any, you know, attenuative white wine strain is going to do good. And then they also sell distiller's yeast. Mm. And at least for commercial brewers, one advantage of those is that a lot of those are packaged with the yeast nutrients they need. So you can, you don't have to worry about yeast nutrition because the, you know, it's packaged in with the you know, liquid yeast.
It seems especially on the home brewing side, you'd want a yeast that was fairly flocculent to save you a lot of trouble in clearing the solution out later on.
Yeah, that would help.
So, and then oxygen would be pretty important here as well.
Yeah, in a sugar wash, even if you've got the right amount of nutrients in it, you still need oxygen, and you're still it's a lot like a mead fermentation, in that those are a lot more twitchy than a beer fermentation. You can get away with a lot in a beer fermentation, and still have the beer turned out turned out at least adequate. In a mead fermentation, you need, you need to take care of things a little bit better, to get the result you want. And in hard seltzers, like the window narrows even further because you're starting with just sugar and just water. And now I've forgotten what the question was.
Aeration.
Oh yeah, aeration. So the usual amount of aeration that you would use in a beer is about right. You know, if you have a DO meter, a dissolved oxygen meter, 6 to 8 parts per million oxygen is what you're shooting for. If you don't, you know, and most brewers don't, about a minute of bubbling with pure oxygen will do it, or, you know, about 8 minutes with the, an aquarium pump pumping just filtered air through it. You know, that'll get you to where you want. You don't want to, you know, if you have any hope of success here, you don't want to rely on the, like, oh, I've got a whisk and I aerate my, you know, work that way. It's like, yeah, that's welcome to failure today.
And we'll get to that in a minute. But
yeah.
So if you do all the things right and you have a healthy fermentation, At the end of it, are you going to be basically completely dry?
You should. Any yeast that's fairly highly attenuative, I'm talking about beer strains, if you're in a situation where there's just glucose, yeast like to take in glucose, and if they've got their other nutritional needs taken care of, it's going to ferment down to, you're going to be at -1.8 to -2 degrees Brix, which is, Brix is sort of like Play-Doh, and it's, about 4 specific gravity points, so, what would that be?
Well, if you're dry, you'd be like 0.998 or 0.988, so you'd be below the specific gravity of water.
Yeah, you'd get down to like 0.992 or something like that. And that's what people are reporting. And then it depends on how much alcohol is in there. The higher the alcohol, the lower the potential specific gravity is going to drop, because alcohol has a specific gravity of like a 0.7 something. I forget the rest. But, then water has a specific gravity, by definition of 1.000. So, the more ethanol you put in a sample of water, the lower below 1.0 the specific gravity is going to drop, assuming there's nothing else in that solution. So, but for -1.8 to -2 Brix is probably what you're going to hit in when you're shooting for a 4-5% alcohol hard seltzer. And then, of course, the commercial brewers do it by, they make up a very strong hard seltzer initially, and then they dilute it down to working strength later to save tank space.
And if you just like in meads and ciders, if you want a sweeter product, you can stabilize it and then back sweeten it. But how often does back sweetening happen with hard seltzers?
A lot of them, maybe even most of them, are they add back like a really low amount, a lot of times under 2 grams per 12-ounce serving of sugar. And then, of course, the commercial brewers stabilize it by pasteurization. As a home brewer, you'd probably do it more like home winemaker and add potassium sorbate and then add your back sweetening.
And then you've got a world of flavors. You can flavor these with any flavor that's available out there.
Yeah, and a nice thing about home brewing is most hard seltzers are, they're not sweet. There's just barely enough sweetness in them to accentuate the fruit flavor a little bit, and the fruit flavor isn't very strong either. As a home brewer, though, you can dial up, the amount of flavor and the sweetness to accentuate it to whatever degree you want. Like there's a commercial brewer or brand called Press Hard Seltzers, and they have their hard seltzers, their 4-5% ones, are like 100 to 110 calories, and they bumped it up just a little bit. And there's a little more sugar, but when you taste them side by side with other hard seltzers, they just taste way better because just a little bit more sugar and a little bit more flavor helps a lot. But them listing 10 more calories per serving keeps their sales down. So, because people aren't looking for, when they shop for hard seltzers, they aren't looking for something that tastes good. They just want to get drunk. And they want to get drunk and not fat.
Well, there you go.
They phrase it better than that, but
yeah. I don't suggest you sign up for the marketing department of any of these companies.
Yeah, no, they wouldn't have me.
So we forgot to talk about getting this stuff clear. We mentioned before, if you're making a malt beverage, then you've got to get some color and maybe some flavor out of the stuff before you flavor it back up again. And then if you're making a quote unquote beer, you've got to make sure that, that it's clear as well. So, I mean, there are approaches that the pros do, and then there are approaches that homebrewers do.
Yeah. And I don't know, one approach a homebrewer can do is just forget about it. You know, if you ferment your hard seltzer, if it looks basically clear and basically colorless, you know, you can choose to skip the hassle of cleaning it up, because, if it's acceptable to you, then why bother? But if you're absolutely hell bent on cleaning it up, if you have a filtration system, plate filters, then what you can do is, use it. Go through your normal filtration to remove yeast and haze, and then do a secondary filtration through a little bit of activated carbon, and that'll clean it up. You can also, if you don't have a filtration system, and most homebrewers don't, you can fine with PVPP, which is usually, it's sold in a lot of homebrewing shops under the name Polychlor AT. You can use PVPP, and then you can follow it up with fining with activated carbon, which sometimes sold as enological carbon at home winemaking shops. And that will, depending on how much carbon you use, small amounts will scrub any aromas, medium amounts will scrub any aromas and flavors, and larger amounts can scrub aromas, flavors, and colors. The only downside is that it's fairly messy. You're going to be cleaning some black sludge from the bottom of whatever, vessel you add it to. But it's at a home scale. It's not, it's not horrifically hard to deal with.
What about gelatin?
Gelatin is usually used for fining for yeast, right? You could use that. Right. That'd be your first fining, and then you'd have to. I don't think gelatin would do anything for aromas or flavors or colors, but I don't know that.
Now, if I make, or when I finish mine, if I finish mine, I'll probably have a New England hard seltzer, a hazy, juicy hard seltzer, because,
Yeah. It's not haze, it's flavor crystals.
Let's take a quick break from hard seltzers to talk about our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. Fall is just around the corner, or at least that's what I'm hoping, and Desiree says they're getting fall seasonal beer ingredient kits ready for highgravitybrew.com. The delicious Ichabod Pumpkin is already available, and their holiday beer is coming soon. And if you buy at least two ingredient kits on highgravitybrew.com, you automatically get 10% off. And that discount is automatic at checkout. High Gravity's ingredient kits are well-tested, many at their tap room, Pippin's Tap Room, so you know they've gotten lots of customer feedback. High Gravity's kits are available for extract and all grain, and you can customize some of them by adding recommended ingredients to kick them up a notch. Check them all out along with the Build Your Own Beer page if you want to use your own recipe. That's at family-owned and operated High Gravity Brew. .com. That's highgravitybrew.com. Now back to Chris. Okay, so, and you've got a ton of recipes in the book for both professionals and homebrewers, including recipes for cocktails that you can make with your hard seltzer. That seems like a natural extension of that.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I wrote the hard seltzer, the cocktail section originally, and most of the cocktails were just based on actual cocktails, but instead of using the seltzer water that goes into it, use hard seltzer. And so it was a mix of hard seltzer and distilled spirits. And because the Brewers Association is publishing the book, they said, "Oh, don't use spirits. Those are our competitors." And so I'm like, "So you want a chapter on cocktails, but I don't use spirits in them?" So anyway, yeah, there's a variety of them that are like mixing hard seltzer with fruit juices and stuff. There's mixing hard seltzers with beer, to sort of make a there's a few beer cocktails out there like the Rattler. I threw in there is a section on using spirits, but that's, yeah, and they all basically, I just took normal relatively well-known cocktails and just tried some batches of, you know, mixing up a hard seltzer version. And those became the cocktails.
Sounds like a couple nights of hard research there at the Colby House.
Yeah.
Okay, and let's talk about, and there's lots of other stuff in the book. You should get the book. But let's talk about me, because that's what, you know, that's what life is all about, right? Me.
It's your podcast.
So my what?
It's your podcast.
Oh, yes. What do you think about the trend of people calling podcasts pods? I don't like it. I don't like it at all. I don't like it when people say, hey, on the pod today. No, yeah. I don't like that.
Yeah. What are you, a group of orcas now? Yeah, stop it.
Okay, before we get your cats riled up. All right, so so on like 10 days ago, I started this hard seltzer, and I said, well, I'm just going to have this. I'm going to fix it all up. I'm going to make it, and I'm going to put it in the kit, and I'll be sipping my hard seltzer when I talk to Chris Colby about his book about how to make hard seltzer. Well, it hasn't worked out so well so far. So here's what I did. Into 4.5 gallons of water, or 17 liters, I put 4 pounds, or 1.8 kilograms of dextrose, otherwise known as glucose. And then I brought it up to a boil for 10 minutes. And then I did a no-chill. So I transferred it into a no-chill cube. And then the next day, I transferred it into a fermenter. And at that point, that's when I added my yeast nutrient. And I added the prescribed amount of yeast nutrient, the little packet that I had, which I believe was DAP. I got it from. I found it in the basement, which may be part of my problem. And I got it from the home brewery back before it turned over into Steve's store, which is a different entity. But anyway, the recommended amount was 1 teaspoon per gallon. So I used 5 teaspoons of the nutrient in the fermenter with a packet of Lalvin EC1118. My starting gravity was 1035, and as of right now, the gravity is still 1035 because it's not. And I thought it was doing something because the next day, 24 hours after I pitched, the airlock was moving a little bit, and so I swirled the carboy, and all this CO2 came out of solution. And so the next morning, you know, it wasn't like actively fermenting, but I'd swirl the carboy again and all this, you know, CO2 came out of solution. So yesterday, you know, I took a gravity reading. And like I say, I'm stuck. And I've never had this. I swear this has never happened before in my 24 or 5 years of brewing. I've never had something just not do anything. But it's doing something, but it's just doing it so slow. It's just making CO2 and not taking the gravity down. So help me, doctor. What's wrong? What have I got going on here?
Well, you've done everything right except for the parts that you didn't do right.
and I didn't. And I said I shook it, and I didn't. I've retired my aeration stone. You know, the little thing that you put the oxygen tank on and stuff. I haven't used O2 in a long time, and I do really well on the brewing side, the beer side. So I just shook this. So that may be one of my problems.
Right. Although I don't think that is the primary problem. Like if the gravity hasn't really budged at all, and I mean it seems weird that it hasn't, given that CO2 is coming off. But if you, it's just really not making any progress at all. My guess is that, yeah, that yeast nutrient was just DAP and that none of the other things that yeast need were in it. Both like Y Yeast and White Labs and I'm pretty sure the other yeast companies sell something that's usually labeled as, you know, complete yeast nutrient or something like that. And it's generally, it's a mix of DAP, or sometimes it might be DAP and urea, which supplies nitrogen. Then it's usually yeast hulls, which are just dead yeast, and they, you know, they have everything in them that yeast cells have. And you know, there's usually a little zinc added to most of them because zinc is a minor nutrient that yeast are sensitive to. And then they might also have, you know, amino acids added, which is, again, another nitrogen source, but one that yeast really like. And so anyway, my guess is that, yeah, the nutrients other than carbon and nitrogen, you'll have carbon from the sugar and nitrogen from the DAP, but all the other things that yeast need were lacking. And actually, your experience is not uncommon. In fact, it seems very common for brewers, even commercial brewers. I just talked to one today that had the same experience, get mixed up everything, and, you know, pitch the yeast and, you know, nothing.
Hmm.
So it's something that, which is one reason I think these are kind of interesting. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of drinking hard seltzers, but as an advanced home brewer, the challenge, I think is interesting, because you really, you need to bring your A game, you know, when you brew these. You've got to, figure out, you know, the amount of, yeast nutrients to add, and then the type of yeast nutrients to add. You know, you need to go, you need to get as much oxygen, you know, pretty much as you can, in there. I mean, you could overdo it with an oxygenation and a stone, but it would be a little hard. But like, you know, a minute of bubbling oxygen through it should do the task. And, you know, like I said, you just need, you need to bring your A game. You need to take care of everything. And I would, if I was, you know, if a home brewer was planning on brewing these fairly, you know, commonly, like if he or she and, you know, anyone that they know liked them, so they were going to, you know, this was going to be a thing where they brewed, you know, every once in a while, every month or so, I would say start out by brewing some 1 gallon batches and figure out what works fermentation wise, you know, and once you're able to crank out, you know, 1 gallon batch consistently, then step that up to you know, 5 or 10 gallon batches.
So should I add oxygen now? I mean, my plan is to go to Steve's shop and get maybe some more yeast and then get some yeast energizer. He sells us yeast energizer. So I want to get some of that and probably some more yeast. And then should I add oxygen now?
If you've got, yeah, you've got essentially no fermentation done. One thing, there's a trick that people use in winemaking. Sometimes when the yeast struggle extensively, they secrete proteins into the mix that then inhibit other yeast. It's like, because normally the yeast cells around them are their descendants, and so if things are tough, they secrete that and the yeast stop working, and then hopefully from the yeast standpoint, and then later sugars arrive. But that means that once a fermentation has failed in your vessel, that solution's going to have proteins in it that suppress fermentation. So you might want to find with something that drags out protein, like a little bit of carbon. Then re-aerate, add nutrients. Well, actually, you've got nutrients in it. But then, of course, if you find for proteins, then that's going to, yeah, add more nutrients and add more yeast. That's what I'd try for a kick save.
This is
or start over.
Yeah, I've only got like $20.
Yeah, it's if you want to try, but it's going to be a lot, you know, a lot of work. And there's, yeah, I mean, it's that's a sort of decision that people have to make. You know, do I want to keep trying to get this to work, or, you know, start over fresh and do it.
It's a challenge now. So I've got to fix this. I got to make it work.
People can follow the course of your potential kick save.
My trials and tribulations. Well, there you go. So it looks easy, or it sounds easy, but maybe not as easy. So you need to get Chris's book and learn how to make hard seltzer. And the name of the book is coincidentally How to Make Hard Seltzer.
Yeah, that's the That's it, all right.
And I don't think I said hard cider once during the show, other than that one time in the beginning. So, yay me.
Yeah, it's good. I didn't make any derogatory comments, at least that I remember, about hard seltzer.
Well, there might have been one or two.
I'll fix it. But it's fine. They're interesting, and the book tells you how to make them. If you don't want to make them, don't make them.
I'm curious now. I might go to the store and just get some. There you go. On the way back from the homebrew store.
I think the challenge aspect is going to appeal to a lot of advanced homebrewers. You know, can I make one of these? And then, you know, so homebrewers are going to have, you know, friends who are like, oh, you know, I like that. Can you make one? And so people are going to, you know, try it, and hopefully they will rise to the occasion.
Yeah, or fall flat on their face like me.
But there's also, I mean, and the great thing about being a homebrewer is you don't have to brew one as they are, you know, as they are now. You could, if you want to make one with like a little sweeter, a little more flavor to them, try different flavors. You know, if you wanted to try to make some sort of beer seltzer hybrid, you know, you've got a ton of possibilities.
Yeah. Well, there you go. All right, Chris, congratulations on another well-written book.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thanks again to Chris. Here's an update on my hard seltzer. I added more yeast and some yeast energizer, and the gravity is finally falling. So next time, I'll know to take better care of my yeast. Get Chris's book, How to Make Hard Seltzer, so you can hit the ground running from the start. Learn from my mistakes. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.